The book today is C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain. It's the second in our sort of week-long Lewis bash. I think that it is probably one of Lewis's most important books. I think if I have a favorite, it would be The Great Divorce. I like The Great Divorce better, but I think that Problem of Pain is the most important. Lewis wrote it in 1940, so he wrote it prior to some of his more popular works, prior to any of the books that we're reading this week. This is the earliest of the books. It was written a couple of years before Case of Mere Christianity. Let me just try to say a little bit about the book, first of all. Maybe the best thing to do is to ask, how many of you have read The Problem of Pain? I've got one, two, okay, three. Quite a few read Mere Christianity yesterday, but we have only three readers of The Problem of Pain. All right, well, the bookstore has it on sale again tomorrow morning, and Edie was sharp enough to buy one this afternoon already, so maybe you'll be moved to make a visit to the bookstore tomorrow. I use Lewis's book as a textbook. I use The Problem of Pain as a textbook in seminary for our course in Introduction to Theology. We read four books in the course of that introductory course. One of them is Lighten Our Darkness, the theme book for this summer. And one of them is Paul Tillich's The Dynamics of Faith. I find Paul Tillich and C.S. Lewis making very similar moves. I wonder if you could close that door. There's kind of a draft going through here somewhere. Maybe that one ought to be closed too. That would be helpful. It's warm when you're in the sun, but it's a little bit chillier sitting in here. Thanks so much. We use Lighten Our Darkness, then we use Paul Tillich's The Dynamics of Faith, and then I use Langdon Gilkey's autobiography of his experiences in a Japanese internment camp in World War II called Shantung Compound. And finally, we use C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain. What all of these books have in common is that they are closely relating theological language to lived experience. Langdon Gilkey's book, Shantung Compound, is about how he began his internment years as a liberal humanist who didn't really think there was much need for God and discovered original sin in Shantung Compound. They were pressed together for 2 years, about 1,400 people. And he discovered that neither education nor religion really affected the behavior, the really selfish behavior of people in that compound. Tells some remarkable stories of how something like power was needed to coerce otherwise well-meaning people into living together with reasonable responsibility. And out of that initial shattering of his own liberal humanism, Gilkey eventually came to become a theologian. Well, Lighten Our Darkness, of course, is a book that many of us have read and talked about here this summer. And Tillich's Dynamics of Faith is an attempt to build an understanding of both God and faith very much out of experiential grounds. Lewis's Problem of Pain shares much in common, has much in common with these other three books, and that's what makes it, I think, a good introduction to theology. Because I think the one thing that we do not need in theology is the construction of a religious ideology, that is, a set of beliefs or statements or doctrines that really don't have anything to do with lived experience. So I find Lewis's book useful, important for that reason. But I think the other reason that this book is, for me, the best of his works is that it represents his own comprehensive statement of how Christianity works. It is his theory of Christianity, I think, more comprehensive than mere Christianity is. Those were more popular broadcast talks. Here he's really trying to make a responsible statement about how Christianity functions, how it works. And he does so by taking up the problem of evil. Pain is, for Lewis at least, the form in which evil encounters us in this world. And the classical statement of the problem of evil has to do with the central affirmations of religion. For classically, the problem of evil goes like this. If there is God and there is evil in the world, then one must either conclude that God is evil, or else he would stop it, prevent it, or one must conclude that evil is more powerful than God. Those seem to be the only two options, for it seems inconceivable that a God who is fundamentally good can permit evil. Albert Camus' sort of classic statement is that he cannot believe in God as long as a single child suffers. And that, for him, is the grounds for saying that there can't possibly be a God, or another way of saying whatever powers there are in the world cannot possibly be good. Camus' heroes, therefore, end up sort of raging and fighting against fate. That's the only humane position Camus sees. He certainly can't buy into religion. But if you listen to the representatives of religion in Camus, Father Panelot, for example, in his book The Plague, what you get is a kind of distorted determinism. Father Panelot says God permits suffering in order to, because his will cannot be questioned, his will cannot be challenged, and basically we are to submit to his will. I can understand why, and for Camus, Father Panelot represents the kind of Christian position. I can understand why Camus would reject that sort of understanding of the solution to the problem of pain and of evil. But Lewis is trying to deal with it very seriously. And the way he does is with his initial chapters on divine power and divine goodness. And he says we need to re-understand both what we mean by God's power as well as by God's goodness if we are going to get a handle at all on the relationship between the goodness of God on the one hand and suffering or pain or evil in the world. The meaning of omnipotence for Lewis is that God has the power to do anything. And the crucial word here is thing. God, when we say all things are possible to God, with God no thing shall be impossible. The key word here is thing. Non-things are not possible even for God. So the old sophomoric question, can God make a rock so big that he can't move it, is dismissed by Lewis as a kind of non-thing. God, with God, things are possible. Therefore, not even God can make a world in which there are free beings and not have to live with the consequences of free beings. All right? So that either God makes a world in which there are no free beings, like people. Or if he makes a world in which there are free beings, then even God is, so to speak, stuck with the consequences of that. For you cannot both have freedom and no evil in the world. For freedom and evil are, in some sense at least, correlatives. That is, they are related to each other. And what does it mean that we are free persons? It means two things. It means, first of all, that we have self-consciousness. I think one of the things that we are probably aware of is that non-human being, non-human existence, animal existence, is really non-self-conscious existence. Curious thing, I don't know where I read it, at a poem somewhere, that only human beings know the names of other things. Birds probably don't know their birds. Dogs don't know their dogs. Mountains certainly may not know they are mountains. We can talk to flowers, I suppose, and who knows, but what tender loving care may do something for flowers. But we are the only ones who name things. Our self-consciousness comes into existence only as we have the relationship of self over against others. We come to self-consciousness in a communal society. We relate to each other as unique beings, and we relate to the rest of creation in the sense that we can give names to. We have a certain sense of control by naming things. But the other thing that characterizes our freedom is not only our consciousness, our awareness of self in distinction to others, but also the fact that there is a neutral environment which permits choice and communication. A neutral environment. Example, this is one that Lewis uses. There are the neutral environment of space and sound waves makes it possible for us to communicate with each other. Otherwise, we would not be able to communicate. My vocal cords vibrate at my will, and that sets sound waves in motion, which vibrate on your ears, and that makes speech possible between us. Without the neutral environment of space and sound waves and so on, we would not be able to communicate with each other. We are able to communicate with each other because of light waves that make visual contact possible. I can see you sitting across from me, and you can see me sitting across from you. Light waves and the refraction of light makes all of that possible. So that's the kind of neutral environment that God creates. That makes choice possible as well. But the moment that you have introduced that environment of choice and self-consciousness, you have also made evil possible. For a neutral environment must be inexorable in its consequences. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to manipulate it. In other words, if there were even the possibility that the sound waves which emit out of my mouth would inexplicably just sort of die midway between me and Rachel, then I could never count on the fact that a word which I would say would actually get to your ears, you see. So I have to count on the fact that that neutral environment is going to operate in a terribly, terribly predictable way over and over and over again. That is, that I can count on it, which means that the same dynamics which make an airplane fly, when the dynamics cease, make that airplane crash inescapably to the ground. The same dynamics that make sound waves and communication possible falter if my vocal cords don't work or if your ears don't function, you see. Then we begin to know that something is wrong either in the transmitting or the receiving mechanism. That neutral environment makes consequences of my choices inescapable. So that if I utilize my liver to digest excessive quantities of alcohol, I am going to wear out my liver. It is going to die on me. It won't function anymore. And it just works that way inexorably, inevitably. So God's power makes the power of God to create the kinds of beings that he has created means that God himself wills a certain limitation on his power by the thingness both of our being and the neutral and social environment that make uniquely human being possible, that make choice and self-consciousness possible. Okay, the second thing that he tries to deal with is divine goodness. If God made this kind of creature with this kind of environment, then maybe it's a sort of cosmic joke. Can we still really say that God is good? Lewis says, again, we have to understand what God's goodness means. And here I think some of his writing reaches really exalted heights. Lewis operates here with the notion of kinds of love, the same sort of thing that he does in his book, The Four Loves. That's an elaboration of the argument that first appears here in Problem of Pain. Lewis says, first of all, that that God's goodness is superior to our notion of goodness, but not discontinuous with it. And one of the things that God's goodness produces is a sense of guilt and a sense of shame in a fallen world. When you meet, Lewis says, when you meet a truly good person, one of your reactions is likely to be a heightened awareness of your own guilt and probably a sense of your own shame. It happened to me when I was, I guess the kind of experience that he talks about happened to me when I was in prep school, and we had a military battalion as a part of this preparatory school, and I had a roommate who never missed reveille. I mean, when the bugle would sound, he just leaped out of bed as if he was made for morning, would do calisthenics before an open window, first one in the bathroom that we had, always got a sink because he was the first one in, first one back to his locker, always dressed and right out there for parade at 7 o'clock. I'm the kind of person who doesn't like to get up on cold mornings for one thing, and I don't like to get up much at all. I was always the last one in the bathroom, and I'd have to wait in line and I was never on time for falling in at 7 o'clock. Used to get demerits almost every morning, and then I'd work them off in the bakery or at the coal pile later on in the day. Well, every time I saw Bruce, I always had this terrible sense of guilt, you know, he can do it, why can't I? That, says Lewis, is what genuine goodness produces in each of us. But then he goes on to say that the love which is God is, and here's a marvelous paragraph, something more stern and splendid than mere kindness, that even the love between the sexes is, as in Dante, a lord of terrible aspect. There is kindness in love, but love and kindness are not coterminous. And when kindness is separated from the other elements of love, it involves a certain fundamental indifference to its object, something even like contempt of it. For kindness really means, I want you to stop bothering me. I'll give you anything so that you stop bothering me. With our friends, our lovers, our children, we are exacting and would rather see them suffer than be happy in contemptible and estranging ways. If God is love, he is by definition something more than kindness. And it appears from all the records, Lewis says, that though he has often rebuked us and condemned us, he has never regarded us with contempt. He has paid us the intolerable compliment of loving us in the deepest, most tragic, most inexorable sense. And then Lewis goes on to say that love by its own nature, the highest form of love that we know, demands the perfecting of the beloved. When we fall in love with a woman, he says, do we cease to care whether she is clean or dirty, fair or foul? Do we not rather then first begin to care? Does any woman regard it as a sign of love in a man that he neither knows nor cares how she is looking? Love may indeed love the beloved when her beauty is lost, but not because it is lost. Love may forgive all infirmities, and love still in spite of them, but love cannot cease to will their removal. Love is therefore more sensitive than hatred to every blemish in the beloved. The feeling of all the powers, love forgives the most and condones the least. He is pleased with little and demands all. That's one of the most important lines, I think, that Lewis probably ever wrote. So what he is saying is that the problem of love and pain can occur only where love has been given a trivial meaning, only where we think that the highest form of love is simply to wish that pain did not occur. Having said, therefore, that God's power is in a sense self-limiting by the kind of creatures that he has made us to be, and then secondly to say that God's love really wills the removal of our fallenness, Lewis then has to go on to say what happens when the object of one's love needs, requires, demands alteration. That is, what happens when the creatures that God has made with self-consciousness and freedom become fallen creatures? They then require alteration. They've got to be changed in order for them to achieve the potential that God has in mind for them. And therefore, Lewis says, God made a world, first of all, in which the fall of human creatures is possible. One of his good lines again is that cows can't fall into sin. You know, they can get into trouble. They cannot enter the barn when they're supposed to, or they can get caught jumping over a barbed wire fence, but they can't really be sinners. The whole notion of moral guilt is unthinkable in the animal world, but it is very thinkable in the human world, because we are creatures open to certain possibilities. We are capable of writing the symphonies of Beethoven and the sonatas of Mozart, and the Lieder of Brahms, and we are also capable, that same nation that gave us Mozart and Bach and Beethoven and Brahms was able to build the concentration camps of Dachau. We are able to create marvelous living spaces in this country and at the same time create the reservations for Native Americans. I mean, see, animals can't do that to each other. We are capable of both the grandeur and the enormities that the human species have visited upon this earth. What we do is the result of our fallenness. It is a loss of status as the species that God intended us to be. Of human beings alone can you say that they are inhuman, less than human. That is, we fall from our own being. You can't say that about beavers or robins or orangutans or even crocodiles who eat missionaries. They have not fallen from their being when they do that. But you see, we can fall from our being. We can torture each other. We can oppress each other. We can enslave each other. We can destroy each other, and in fact, destroy ourselves as well. We can hurt each other because God made the environment in which we live that kind of environment, and therefore we cannot recover from our fallenness without pain. Lewis then stresses the pain that we experience and need to experience in three ways. First of all, pain is unmasked evil in contrast to error and to sin. See, it's possible for us to sin without having that sin immediately unmasked as sin. It is possible for us to err without having that error immediately unmasked in a painful way. I've sent in my income tax form the last 3 years, and in 1976 and in 1977, I got letters from the IRS both times saying, you've got to be audited. So I took all my books and papers and records and everything else down to the IRS office, and in both instances, they demonstrated to me that I had indeed made some errors, not just mathematical errors, but some conceptual errors in the way I read the IRS laws. I have a fairly complicated tax return because I've been commuting the last couple of years to Hama and have a room there in the dormitory and some deductible living expenses and travel expenses and so on, and I found that some of the things I was deducting were not deductible and others were, and it was a crazy business. Well, at the time that I sent in the form, I was indeed in error, but I had no knowledge of it. It wasn't until months later, 6-7 months later, that the knowledge came, and it was slightly more painful than the original paying of the tax because I hadn't budgeted the new payments that I owed. So error can be made by any of us without our being aware of it. I can think things that are in error without my even knowing that. Students hand in papers all the time in the confidence that it is the last word on the subject until I get a hold of them with my red pencil, you see. They are blissfully unaware of their errors in thinking or logic or biblical interpretation and so on. We can also sin without an awareness of error or without an awareness that it is in fact sin. It's possible all the time for us to do that. I think that America's involvement in Southeast Asia, the more I learn of it, and the deeper its roots and causes go back to some very shabby trading that we did with the French right after World War II, where we sort of traded their participation in NATO for our looking the other way while they went back to try to colonize Southeast Asia once again. That was the first fundamental blunder that we made, which says to me in a way that you can't trade away other people's freedom without sooner or later, at some point in history, paying a terrible price for it. I don't think America has yet paid the full consequences for the follies of four presidential administrations in Southeast Asia. And those countries are paying even more terribly for our folly right now than they would have had we simply not turned our backs on the French going back there in Southeast Asia. But it's possible for us, you see, to participate in this year after year, and for many honorable people, my uncle who's a retired colonel in the United States Army among them, to participate in that whole business without even being aware that it was a sinful business. So we can commit both sin and error without awareness of it. But pain, Lewis says, is unmasked evil. You know, there's no way in which you can say, nothing is wrong, when the pain is jabbing away at you. So Lewis's first point is, God builds pain into the universe as a way of unmasking evil. Secondly, pain shows that what we have is neither our own nor enough. This again is one of Lewis's great lines. If the root sin of human beings is to want to be on our own, to want to make it on our own, to want to be our own gods and masters, then pain is the way God calls our bluff, in a sense. It's the way he says to us, that is an illusion. It is a lie. You are not on your own. You are not self-sufficient creatures. You do not control your own destinies. Here is the boundary line. This is the limit on your pretension and your pride, thus far and no farther. And finally, God uses pain, or I shouldn't say God uses pain. If we are indeed a fallen creation, then there will be no turning from that fallenness. There will be no removal of that fallenness without pain. Repentance and redemption are indeed painful processes for God as well as for us. He bears the pain of the cross, spares himself not even his own son, but delivers him up for us all, as Paul says in his epistles. And therefore will with him give us all things. But the giving of us, giving of all things to us, means that our turning around also is going to be a painful turning around. God's redemption does not enter a vacuum. It enters already occupied territory. And to deliver us from the occupation of the enemy, of the evil, of the sin, of the old self and the old age, means that there's going to be pain involved. There is no new creature except that the old self dies. Therefore, we put sin to death and rise to newness of life. And if Luther is right, that is a daily event for Christians. We remain in the struggle against sin, and therefore the pain involved, until the moment of our death. For the final death of the old age and the old self occurs only when I die. In that sense, Lewis is saying, God's goal for us is our ultimate perfection, but that perfection will not occur until the old self has been completely eliminated and eradicated. Luther's picture, therefore, of the Christian life is not kind of steady progress, eliminating sin and pain until finally at the moment of death we've gotten rid of it all. It's more a jagged line. The temptations and the struggles of youth give way to the temptations and the struggles of maturity, and then the temptations and the struggles of middle age, and then finally a whole new set of assaults and temptations and struggles in old age, so that we are constantly having to do battle, constantly having to put something to death in us. Well, anyway, Lewis's point, therefore, is that God uses pain. One can even say in his most daring metaphor, God inflicts pain as a way to unmask our condition, as a way to call a halt to our evil, and as a way to redeem us. There is no way in which we are going to be redeemed except through pain. The suffering of Jesus is critical to all of this because it is God's cost in the redemptive process. Ours is that we too suffer with him now. That makes our own pain meaningful instead of meaningless suffering. And finally, Lewis's point is that hell itself has to be a reality if we are to take seriously the freedom that we have. The gift of freedom is a two-edged gift, and it is possible for rebellion to be final. That is, for us finally to say an absolute and unconditioned no to God's redemptive offer. And because that is a real possibility, because God has built it in, then hell is not so much God zapping us, it is the final consequence of our own refusal to be part of the redemptive offer of God. The door to hell, somebody has said, can only be opened from inside. It can't be battered down, or God would be destroying the very freedom that he has given us as his creatures. Hell is the final consequence, therefore, of freedom. Well, I think that's enough of an exposition of his book. Let's use the rest of the time to talk about it.
Why do we feel guilt for that instead of mourn that situation when we confront it?
Feel guilt for what?
For that person who finally says no that we're associated with. I have that problem, and I see other people having. Instead of being able to simply mourn the fact that person has cut himself off, we take guilt upon ourselves for that cut-offness from God. Maybe I'm just wondering if, you know, I've heard other people express that. I don't know if that's universal or not.
Well, I think that may probably be, if we do feel guilt, it would probably be, Lewis would say, a symptom of our own non-trusting of God at this point. For if we really did trust God, we would be able to, I think, accept the limitations of our own efforts as well as the limitations that he has built into his own creation. So maybe that's the pain that is needed at this point to call attention to your own untrust. Please.
To accept the freedom of choice that God gives all of humanity.
I didn't hear the first part of that sentence. Go ahead.
It seems like we find it difficult to accept the freedom of choice that God gives all of us.
Yes.
When we make ourselves responsible for others and feel badly because they turn against God, we really aren't accepting the freedom that he has given all of us.
Given them as well as
us.
Yes. Yeah. Please.
You said earlier, as Lewis works through the problem of evil, he has will to limit his power because of the kinds of creatures or created beings he has created. Well, we've done that, but anyway. How is C.S. Lewis a free will person then? How would he react to bondage of the will?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I think in this sense at least, Lewis is British. But at the same time, I think it's possible to harmonize both Lewis's assertion of human freedom and Luther's assertion of the bondage that we are in. For, let me try to put it this way, Lewis does believe, and says so very carefully here, Lewis does believe in the fallenness of all of humanity. And what happens to freedom in its fallenness is that our choices do not reveal God's intention for us, but our choices now in our fallenness reveal the fallen state. They reveal our bondage. So, for
a choice, then, if that was to carry through, then what is a choice for Lewis? That is not a choice, really.
It is and it isn't. How shall I put it? We have three television networks in America, and if you live in a city like Chicago or New York or I don't know where else, but those two at least, you may have a wider range than that. So in one sense, we do have real choices between the television networks. But that freedom of choice that we have does not, in a fallen humanity, does not lead to real potential. It leads simply to competition for how banal, how insipid the networks can be. Laverne and Shirley is the bell ringer of television shows. Well, our freedom, therefore, does not reveal how creative we are, but rather how insipid and how stupid our entertainment can be. The freedom of choice that we have had in dealing with our world has, in fact, been real freedom. That is to say, we are not instinctual creatures, predictable creatures, let's say, in our use of oil, zinc, gold, iron ore, and so on. And yet, what a fallen humanity does with that freedom is simply to reveal that we are vast exploiters, polluters, and destroyers of our environment.
Well, then, is the freedom that C.S. Lewis is positing if we're going to try and lay over Luther's thing there, the two kingdoms? Is it the kingdom on the left, then the worldly kingdom that we're talking about in the problem of pain? And so the bondage is only relation to God for Luther. We have freedom to
choose
among things. And so the evil that he's saying is evident because of our freedom in the world.
Yeah, I would understand. Let me try to say first of all that Luther and Lewis live 4 centuries apart. There is no possibility that they're both saying the same things. But I think that they can be pointing to similar realities. First of all, somebody just carried somebody else in on shoulders. I'm not quite sure that the stairway or the doorways were made for that. I'm uncomfortable with Luther's saying that our bondage is only in relation to God, that we are free in relation to other things. I think it's probably more devastating than Luther says, for I think we do encounter God in the bondages that are revealed in the freedoms that we have over against what Luther would call the things below, all right? Now, that means, it seems to me, that we do encounter the judgment of God in the choices that we make. We encounter God's judgment in those choices. If I consume too much alcohol so that my liver can't handle it and destroy my liver, that is an encounter with God, and that is a judgment upon my misuse of the gift of alcohol. Nevertheless, freedom is an appropriate word to use here, because I am what sociologists call world open, as opposed to an instinctual creature. I have choices of habitat, environment, movement, social relationships, careers, actions at any given moment. You cannot predict, for example, whether I'm just going to get up and walk out in the next 30 seconds or whether I'll stay here till 5 o'clock. I'm not predictable in the sense that, let's say, a chipmunk is predictable. So we do have a certain valid freedom, but what it reveals is a bondage that may even be deeper than Luther thought was possible. So I think that's the way I'd want to harmonize Lewis and Luther at this point. One thing we haven't talked about is another kind of pain, namely the kind of pain that comes just physical suffering. My mother's arthritis, for example. She writes about it in almost every letter. She's 78. I know it's painful for her, and medication is the best that she can get, but it still doesn't relieve her. Or in my first parish, a woman died over a 2-year period of bone cancer, multiple myeloma. It was painful beyond words. The thing that doesn't satisfy me fully in what Lewis is writing here is that kind of pain. I don't know what to say about that either. What kind of wisdom do you have? There must be some wisdom here in the midst of all of us.
Well, I guess in counseling, I deal with that in the whole power, the concept of power of evil in the world. And as God allows evil, it's allowed certain powers. That doesn't make it particularly more understandable. But I think it's important that we watch out how we put God's intentionality into that kind of pain. And that's probably about as helpful a explanation as I can work with, that I've been able to discover to work with, the evil and demonic forces are active.
Yeah, I don't know that I would want to assert that of something like disease, though. It seems to me that we can't simply say cancer equals evil. It's just a different, I think it's in a different category. The kind of evil Lewis is talking about here has to do with sin, with error, with fallenness. And I don't know that that's the same thing as some disease.
I was going to say in the sense that it is caused by environment or something like that, that we have been careless. I mean, I suppose we could use that.
Yes, in that sense, cirrhosis of the liver caused by excessive use of alcohol.
Or pollutions, or diseases
that are caused by pollutants.
Well,
yes.
Wouldn't any problem, any solution to the problem of evil be inadequate unless it dealt with all evil? And isn't all kinds of diseases and all kinds of injuries, whether they're caused by human sin or not, evil? You know, the whole creation moans and travails until
coming. Yeah, yeah.
You know, is the fall so affect all of the universe and all creation that sin has caused the pain, so it's connected with sin throughout?
Yeah, Lewis has six propositions in chapters 6 and 7 of this book, and maybe I should just read them because they're kind of a summary. He says there is a difference, first of all, between serving God as a son or daughter, that is, as his child, and serving God as a tool. Every human being serves God as a tool, but only those who want to participate in his redemptive activity serve him as his children. That is indeed what it means to be a child. In one of his most marvelous essays, Lewis says that we should not draw hasty conclusions from the ways in which God seems to answer our prayers. He thinks that is probably the result of people who are very much beginners in the faith, that the farther we get into being Christians, the more will be asked of us, the more suffering will be ours. And he says the one who was most perfectly the Son of God was the one who was sent to the loneliest outpost of all on the cross, saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? So that signs of healing, for example, which are surely part of Jesus' own ministry, are the beginning signs of the kingdom, not the deepest ones, not the signs of his our deepest involvement in the redemption of God. And I think that's always a helpful thing to say. I was thinking about this last night in the discussion too. We must never conclude that non-answer to our intercessions for healing on behalf of some person are a sign of unbelief, either on our part or on the part of the person for whom we pray. They may very well be precisely the opposite, as Lewis tries to say, that in fact the preliminary signs of the kingdom are the healings, rather than the deepest sign. The deepest sign of the kingdom is the cross. That is the deepest sign. The others were the preliminary signs. So, second point, suffering will not cease until the world itself is beyond redemption. When all of God's redemption has achieved its goal, then there will be no more suffering. The third point, self-surrender is a theological term, not a political one. Fourth, we are never safe, but we may have some fun along the way. Fifth, there is no sum of suffering. That is, suffering does not increase because two people are suffering, or six, or 10, or 1 million, or 100 million. The amount of suffering is like death, one per person, and that's all there is. And finally, pain is sterilized evil, Lewis says. It does not proliferate. There are unsterilized forms of evil, sin, temptation, error, can indeed proliferate and have consequences far beyond a single generation, unto the third and fourth generation, the Old Testament says. I think about that when I think of Vietnam. I really think that the sin and the error of Vietnam is proliferating well beyond our generation and well beyond our country. Certainly what's happening to Cambodia today is a proliferation of that evil. But pain, he says, is sterilized evil. It doesn't proliferate. Well, I don't know whether, again, those propositions of his are helpful, but they may be. You had your hand up back there. Oh, yeah. Okay. How do you react to all of this? I think Lewis has kind of staked out here a very bold and realistic and courageous statement. What are you saying? Are you sort of nodding? Are you saying, yeah, that all makes sense, it's a way to think about it, or are you reacting against it? Any kind of reaction? Go ahead, please.
Pain, as you've described to me, sounds like it was just, it's just a reaction to our humanity. It's not an imposition by the will of God. It's just a part of living. A part of
fallen living, Lewis would say.
Our human condition. Our fallen condition.
Yeah, all right. Let me try to phrase your contrast then. What you're saying is pain is not as if God is sort of running around seeing whom he can catch at something and then zapping. Uh-huh. It's rather a part of the inevitableness of a world and a humanity created as God has created us, with a neutral environment that where the consequences of our freedom are inexorably visited, in a sense, upon us. One of the things I would want to interpose here, and I don't remember Lewis saying anything like this, is we must not draw direct line consequences. For example, my mother died, when I told you about my mother, it was really my stepmother. My mother died when she was 40 and I was 16 of a unnecessary complication. She had a bowel obstruction that resulted from an earlier operation, which was inadequately performed. Now, I do not say, what did she do, you see, that she deserved this? That's an inadequate way. But what Lewis is trying to say is that pain generally in the world is the consequence of a fallen humanity. If you'd like to read in fiction form Lewis's attempt to describe a world where there is no sin, it would be in Out of the Silent Planet, beautiful little novel of Lewis's. And there he has a couple of human beings landing on a planet where there are intelligent creatures, but no sin. And it's interesting the way he describes that. He describes how creatures who are not fallen can die in such a way that death is not experienced as a judgment. It's a very interesting picture that he describes there. Yes, you were going to say something.
Well, I think you sort of answered it, because I was too concerned about the idea of the direct route between, you know, pain and an individual suffering. I think that's what a lot of people have done. And sometimes we can do that with our own suffering. We can see that out of this something, you know, I
something redemptive
yes,
comes.
Yes, right,
yeah.
But to impose that upon someone else, it's very difficult to draw that directly, and or to say that that suffering is there because in order for the rest of us to. I mean, it's just such a shaky thing to deal with, because it can be misinterpreted so easily. Then that God is pushing buttons and saying, okay, this is your role. And I liked what you answered it for me when you said the whole.
The supper bell is going to ring in a moment. Let me just conclude with this word. I think we are to draw our conclusions about God's commitment to us not from what's going on day by day in our own lives, but from the cross itself. For God's commitment to us, Lewis says, is that he is going to deliver us no matter what it costs him. That's the first point. And then, no matter what it costs us.